It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin state lawmakers are at odds over rules for election observers and how to ensure local officials stay compliant with administrative rules.
Last year, Governor Evers vetoed a Republican bill that would have given election observers closer access to local officials during the voting process.
This week, the Assembly's Campaigns and Elections Committee voted against recommending a new set of standards for poll watchers.
And this comes as voters will be asked in the April 1st election to enshrine the state's voter ID law into the state constitution.
We're checking in now on voting and election administration with a pair of lawmakers who serve on the Assembly's seven-member Campaigns and Elections Committee.
Republican Representative Scott Krug is here, Assistant Majority Leader, Vice Chair of this committee, and represents a district that covers parts of Adams, Juneau, and Wood counties in central Wisconsin. And we have Democratic State Representative Lee Snodgrass, representing a district in east central Wisconsin, including most of Appleton and parts of Grand Chute. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Representative Krug, let's start with you. Can you get us on the same page here as to where we are now with current rules for election observers in Wisconsin, and how are these rules enforced?
Yeah, so right now what the overall goal of lawmakers is to try to standardize rules across municipalities. Having 1,800-plus municipalities run local elections, it's hard to have one set standard unless we find a way to get that done. So that's where we're sitting right now, is trying to standardize rules either through the rulemaking process, or I think one of the stronger ways to do it is actually through state statute. So we actually have both sides of the equation represented in this discussion. Observers, we talked about last session, like you mentioned, is had a bill that came up to change the distance for observers. We're not looking to do things like that this time around. We just want to make sure that everybody understands a standard that can be acceptable across the board and that we use it in every municipality in the state of Wisconsin.
And Representative Snodgrass, what kind of work is going into trying to establish new rules for election observers? What has this process been like?
Well, I actually think I'm glad to hear my colleagues say that this clarifies what election observers, what their rights are. And frankly, it also clarifies what, chief clerks can do if somebody is disruptive. I think that where we differ is that I am really satisfied with the report that the Wisconsin Elections Commission's put out. It was this rule was written in a bipartisan fashion. One of them who wrote it was a Voss appointee. The other is a Democratic appointee, and they did it in a very transparent process, a very long process where they involved many stakeholders from both types of opinions, both for and against certain things. And, you know, I feel the rule is very clear, and that is the purpose. We ask administrations, commissions to develop rules that clarify things so that things can be more easily referred to and enforced. And they did just that. And I don't really see why we're not adopting the rule. I feel that we're using political games to sort of send this back into a process, which we've seen before with other issues. It's an ad nauseum loop.
And Representative Krug, why did ultimately the Assembly Committee on Campaigns and Elections vote against recommending these new proposed standards through the rules package?
Yeah, you know, there's two actual real good reasons why we did this. Is the first reason I think we heard during the hearing on the rules package. So we wanted to also have a standard in place that if a municipality or their chief election inspector wasn't following the standards that were put in place, that there would be some sort of a recourse for the observer, either in state law or an administrative rule that just didn't exist. And that's something that we need to visit in this package that we're going to take up legislatively through a bill that can become state law that'll enforce it even more. Secondly, I think even bigger, we see right now that the state Supreme Court is having a case in front of them right now that deals with JCRAR, the Joint Committee on Rule Review, and what their authority might be for objecting to rules. So to say this is a political process, objecting to an administrative rule in committee takes that out of the equation between the state Supreme Court and JCRAR, that the rules can actually be adopted into law without having to go through JCRAR, where the concern has typically been indefinite objections to rules and letting them sit on the shelf without implementing them. So I think the faster way through is to exercise the goodwill that we've established on this committee and actually write a bill that reflects 90-some percent of what, you know, WEC had put forth in this package, but also addresses the other 10% of making sure that there's some recourse for observers if something doesn't happen, and coming up to a bipartisan solution that the governor can sign into law.
And I want to talk more about the bill in the moment, but I want to ask you, Representative Krug, in terms of election officials, you have said that you want to make them have more skin in the game when it comes to following rules for what election observers can and can't do. Will a slate of penalties deter poll workers from volunteering or stepping up to administer elections?
Yeah, you know, it's not even so much penalties. It's just to have a process of recourse put into place for an observer to say, hey, I don't like what's going on here. Here's my next step. And that doesn't mean that we're going to, you know, start throwing misdemeanors around to poll workers or to chief election inspectors or municipalities. What we're saying is we just want a standard that's put into place to say, okay, this is the step you need to take, observer. If you feel that your rights are not being allowed to be exercised, this is where you need to take that to, whether it's going to be a local DA to have to come investigate or it's going to be an election judge of some sort that can be appointed. We don't know that mechanism quite yet, but nobody's talking penalties. We just want to have steps in place that an observer can say, hey, this isn't happening the way state law says. This is what I need to do next.
We are talking. Oh, sure, sure. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I would just say that that is exactly what the rule that was presented by WEC did. It did put that mechanism into place of here's the recourse and here's what to do and here's the process. So I love the work that we're doing on this committee. Representative Krug and I have worked extremely well together, even when we differ on issues. I don't trust it beyond this committee. We have seen good things go through the committee and then die and not get a hearing in the major body. So I think we've got something we can take action on here right in front of us, and to wait and see if we can get the full body on board with something we've created in the committee, to me, is an extra step and an extra risk.
That is Democratic State Representative Lee Snodgrass of Appleton with us, and we have Republican Assistant Majority Leader Scott Krubes, who serves on the Assembly Committee on Campaigns and Elections, as we talk about election observers and voting administration in Wisconsin. And I'm wondering, Representative Snodgrass, is there any thing in this committee looking into rules related to election observers who observe absentee voting at like residential care facilities or at nursing homes?
That's been something that we've also discussed. Certainly in the hearing, it came up. You know, there are issues of privacy. There are people in residential care facilities who cannot leave their room. And to have an observer go into that private space of somebody really is a violation of privacy. So we want to make sure that whatever is put forward is very cognizant of the fact that, you know, not everybody can go to a main area in the facility that they live in. Some people are really restricted to those bedrooms, those private spaces, and having an observer there feels quite like a violation of privacy.
Representative Krug, would you like to respond to that?
I think she's right. That's one of the things that as we were going through the process of hearing this rule package, that even my Republican colleagues and I are having sidebars on as folks came to testify saying they wanted to demand more access to that individual's bedroom, that even my Republican colleagues on the committee and I were chatting as we could, listening at the same time, of course, but looking at each other saying, yeah, we don't do that if I take my absentee ballot to my house and sit in my kitchen. I don't have an observer. So we're not going to take it into this rules package to say, hey, we're going to force that interaction to become even more intrusive. But at the same time, there are bills that will be floating around this session through the committee that'll address the process and the standards and determinations of incompetency and all these other things that go into voting with a special voting deputy. And, you know, we talked about those issues last session and we'll dive into them again this session.
And so with the bill you're working on, the legislation you're working on with standards for election observers, are you confident it could get across the finish line?
I don't see why not. I mean, this is one of those prime examples of exactly what we did last session, where we would hear a bill, understand that there's some things in there we don't agree on, try to work through those issues and get a bill in front of us, the entire committee can get to the floor. And I think it's even more important for us to recognize that our work as legislators to get a bill to the floor is going to be a lot easier than shipping it off to another committee who can just sit on it for as long as they want. So to get more buy-in, it creates more conversation between both parties to try to come to an agreement, understanding that Republicans in the legislature are going to need the Democrat governor to sign on to whatever we send to him. So we started seeing that a little bit last session, where we actually got some election bills signed into law.
You are both participating in a roundtable discussion in Milwaukee on Monday with the group All Voting is Local. Representative Snodgrass, why is having these kinds of across-the-aisle conversations important?
Well, I think, you know, unfortunately or unfortunately, Scott and I have set a standard of being able to have deep dialogue on things we may disagree on and to do it respectfully. We've kind of laughed that we've both gotten some local and national accolades for this type of work, when really this should be the standard. It should be the standard that you work in good faith with one another, even when you disagree, and you focus on those areas where you can agree. So I'm hoping that we can continue to model. I mean, we obviously both disagree on whether or not this constitutional amendment should be on the ballot this April. And I think we're going to have another really good discussion about the various perspectives on that. And I think it's important for the people in the state to see those discussions and hear those.
And Representative Krug, what are you hoping that comes out of a roundtable discussion in Milwaukee?
Yeah, you know, my favorite part of, you know, having volunteered to get into this election realm last session was trying to figure out different perspectives from different people across different parts of the state. And, you know, we have to recognize that we are not always experts on everything, so we need to get out and hear exactly what people are thinking in different communities. And, you know, Sam Liebert and I connected last session just on that same topic of being open, being bipartisan, being able to listen. So that's where this kind of developed into, is a couple of weeks before the state constitutional question, just to be in a community that I'm not completely familiar with, just to get some input from people on what the future of photo ID looks like, knowing that it's probably going to pass, probably going to be constitutional. But also understanding within that constitutional amendment, we did say that exceptions will be able to be made by lawmakers on different types of IDs to be used, different processes to obtain IDs. So that's the future of photo ID, is figuring out what those exceptions should look like into the future and if we need to make other accommodations.
And we have to leave it there with Representative Scott Krug, Assistant Majority Leader, Democratic Representative Lee Snodgrass joining us as well.
Coming up, a Wisconsin researcher interviewed tween girls about their social media experiences. She tells us what she learned.
Care so much about privacy, but they're also balancing that with this call to be visible.
That's coming up here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tween girls today are the same as tween girls from previous generations. They play, they hang out with their friends, and they're at a point in life when they're starting to figure out who they are.
The difference is a lot of their lives now take place online. And social media isn't a separate reality for them. It's just another part of reality.
Our next guest says, we often talk about tween girls, but we don't talk to them. So she decided to see what these girls had to say about their social media use, the role it plays in their lives, and if, like so many adults, they also see it as a harmful influence.
Catherine Phelps is the author of the new book, Digital Girlhoods, and teaching faculty in the Gender and Women's Studies Department at UW-Madison. Kate, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a delight.
There's a lot of talk, as you talk about in your book, in the media about young girls, the tween girls, and how they interact with social media. A lot of talk about them.
Yes.
You did something a little different. You went and talked to them.
I did.
Why was that such an important part of your research?
Well, and I think rightfully so. It is difficult to access that population of people, that demographic of people, but it really struck me how much public discourse and what felt really very much like panic was happening around girls in online space, and very specifically around this demographic of younger tween girls who are making their foray into these social media spaces and platforms. And I felt that the narrative that we were painting on the part of adults was perhaps not very nuanced. It was a little too simplistic. And I just was like, I need to talk to this group of humans and find out what they think about social media. So I had to be very intentional and careful about the kinds of questions I was crafting in interviews. But what I found was that girls really wanted to talk about it. They wanted the opportunity to share about this thing that they had been introduced to, that they were growing up with, and that was shaping their lives in really profound ways.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that struck me as you share examples, of course, anonymized from the girls you talk to. I think sometimes in the popular press and culture, we think of kids just sort of blundering into this online world thoughtlessly. They really do think a lot about what they see and what they share online, don't they?
They do. They are strategic, savvy social media users. And I was so privileged to get the opportunity to speak with many of them, certainly. And it's not a massive study in that way. I talked to 26 tween girls between the ages of 10 and 13. But what I found was, over the course of doing these interviews, this saturation point where I'm hearing a lot of shared themes. They care so much about privacy, but they're also balancing that with this call to be visible and wanting to represent themselves.
That balancing act keeps going throughout your book, and you look at two conflicting pressures, the idea of girls this age and other ages for that matter as innocent girls that need protection, right? And you mentioned the worries about privacy and strangers and concern about that versus a societal pressure to embrace a kind of girl power.
Yes.
To say, hey, you need to craft your identity. You need to show the world who you are. Those are not the same things. They are mutually contradictory.
Yeah.
How did girls talk about that?
They talked about that dilemma often in the very same breath. Girls understand very much they have been conditioned to fear this specter, in particular of the strange man online, this predator that looms, you know. And to me, what's so striking about that is that we're putting so much responsibility on a 12-year-old and saying this person needs to pull themselves offline, or we need to protect them from being in online space because of who might be watching them, which I think needs to be a totally reframed conversation about how we have situated girls throughout history, in media, in popular culture, and these very competing demands that we put on them. It's really hard to be a girl. It's very confusing.
I want to dig more into that in a minute, but I want to stay with some of the practical ways that girls are using social media. There are things where you're kind of broadcasting to the world, like YouTube and the pretty or not videos. YouTube, it's gone to other platforms over the years.
Yes.
But you found a lot of what girls are doing with social media is interacting with the same people that they might see at school or in their neighborhood.
Correct. They are primarily communicating with friends, with people that may have gone to school with them that have since moved, that they want to stay in contact with. This is how young people are communicating with each other. And so much of what they're doing is within smaller circles of friends, people that they know. And I think that's really important. And the data and some of the research across explorations into social media and this demographic of adolescent girls or tween girls is demonstrating that. They're not engaging in a bunch of what we might consider to be high-risk behavior. They're having fun with their friends. Yeah.
The girls you talk to also talk about potential negatives of being on social media. A lot of adults certainly worry about cyberbullying.
Yes.
And I thought it was fascinating. Two different girls you talked to had very different. One said, yeah, cyberbullying, way worse than in-person bullying because you can't get away from it. One's like, no, in-person bullying, way worse. You just delete that and forget about it. Interesting, different attitudes toward how we deal with bullying on social media.
Yes, and one of the difficulties of this as well is what we as adults might perceive to be bullying, that's a Tuesday for girl, right? Like it may or may not be perceived that way. And they have individual perspective and ideas on what that feels like. I also think it's so important to note that while cyberbullying can and does occur, it is often happening again with people that know each other in real space and real time. And I think it's really crucial to clarify how we have conditioned young girls to relate to one another. When we think about that, it maps so beautifully onto social media use. Things like passive-aggressive behavior, rumor spreading, gossip, silence, character attacks, things like that can move onto social media pretty seamlessly in a way that aggressive behavior in and amongst boy children is very, very different. And we haven't, I don't know that we've really deepened our inquiry into that. We need more research that looks at these gender dynamics of bullying online. Yeah.
I'll say, as somebody in the media, I've probably done and accepted more pitches on the bad stuff, right, of kids online. And it's out there, and you acknowledge that in the book. But again, a lot of the girls you talk about what a positive experience, or at least partially positive experience, it is a way to build community, to build relationships with their friends.
Yeah. That's the thing that makes me so nervous about some of what's going on in the world right now. I mean, Australia has passed this bill that will ban young people under the age of 16 from social media over the course of the next year. And other countries are paying attention to that policy-wise. Do not mistake me. I think we need very clear, open dialogue and discussion with our young people about what social media means to them, how they use it, why they use it. I think there are so many important opportunities and possibilities that come with being able to self-represent. That's something that's so striking to me, is we worry about girls in public space. We worry about who might be looking at them. We worry about things like body image comparison and negative body image. This did not come to us from social media. Social media is like an infant. We don't know what its net negative or positive impacts are going to be. And that's something I want to pay attention to in the long term. Girls have fun online. They create videos. They are coders. They are dancers. They are comedians. They're doing incredible content creation. And they get to be a part of it in a way that I think we forget. Girls helped make social media what it is. So I think it's damaging and indeed dangerous, this idea of policing their behavior to such a degree that we're going to pull them offline. Because what we're saying is then, by virtue of their gender identity, by virtue of their age, they are automatically high risk. And if that's the case, then we need to be having a very different conversation.
Now, mentioning that Australia law reminds me, we're talking about kids 13 and under, technically by terms of use and things like that. They're not supposed to be there.
Sure aren't. Yep. And yet they are. They are. And they are very prolific online. I think that says a lot to the responsibility and accountability that these platforms need to have in regulating those age limits. But it also says something broader about, in particular, what the last handful of years has meant in the midst and wake of COVID. Because this is how young people were communicating when they were pulled out of school. The access that they had to their social networks was primarily through personal devices, or whether family devices or otherwise. And it is true that it is harder to make something like a personal YouTube channel if you are under the age of 13, which also means that a really significant number of the young people, the girls that were making the Pretty or Ugly videos, for example, are using family accounts, are using parental accounts to do that. Certainly finding loopholes, getting past those regulations, because this is the modus operandi of how this generation is connecting with one another. And kind of whether we like it or not, we need to reckon with what that means.
We're talking to Kate Phelps from UW-Madison, author of the new book, Digital Girlhoods. I'm going to do a little read from your book here. Popular culture and mass media tell girls to be confident, but not too confident. Be vulnerable, but do not show too much of yourself online. Be authentic, but only in appropriately self-effacing ways. Be pretty, but not vain. Be thin, but not too thin, but certainly not fat. Be smart, but not too smart. Be active, but do not bypass the boys. Be a leader, but in a suitably feminine way. Be sexy, but not slutty. Okay, if I took the word online out there, I bet that would sound very familiar to women of a number of generations
absolutely.
Before social media ever came around.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is not new. Me naming these paradoxes, this set of contradictions that not only girls of a variety of identities and embodiments are experiencing, but this is something that is experienced across the life course for people that identify as female and feminine. And these sets of contradictions are something that have colored the experiences of women and girls in particular for a very long time, especially as women and girls have gained seemingly more political power. I think ideologically we're very on board with this girl power idea. But it's something that we're selling, and we're selling individual empowerment in particular through consumption. We do that through very recognizable brands, and girls are drawn to that. And then we turn right around and we say, wait a minute, this interest in makeup is so vapid, is so shallow. But what? We're laying that bare for girls. We are selling it to them. And then we turn around and disdain that interest primarily because we've associated it with femininity. I think this sort of reclamation of femininity and what girls are doing online and how they are performing girlhoods is so powerful. There's agency there. There's disruption. There's the creation of new narratives and counter narratives that cuts through some of this because girls know. They recognize this endless, seemingly endless series of contradictions about who they're supposed to be and how. And the ability to represent themselves on these platforms demonstrate their interests, their depth, their value, what they find meaningful. I think there's a lot to pay attention to. If we're interested in who girls are and what they're doing, they're telling us. We just have to value it enough to look at it.
Looking at it from a grown-up perspective now, in a lot of ways, the arguments we're having about social media are, like you say, the things we were talking about before social media. I and a lot of people were parents in an age where our kids were hitting social media, and I couldn't look back and say, well, when I was a kid on social media,
right.
Because there wasn't social media when I was a kid, it feels really dramatically different. How do you split that? How do you maybe bring those two generations together?
Girls are already having really meaningful conversations with parental figures, with caretakers, with stakeholders in their lives, with their peers about privacy, about how they make content public versus private, how they talk about it with their friends. I think we need to give them more credit. And that is a very noticeable pattern of, I mean, I catch myself doing it too, of, well, it wasn't like this when I was a kid. That is a tale as old as time, right? And some of the moral panic behind it. This idea that social media is the Wild West in this totally unregulated space, I think we need to give girls more credit, but also open ourselves up to what girls have to say. I think about one of my interviews, I mean, several of them spoke to ideas around this, but a 12-year-old black girl named Jessie, who really stands out in my mind, had so much energy around this idea of creating a YouTube channel for dance and for doing choreography. She had had a conversation with her mother about what that would look like and had a whole plan because she knew that in order to be recognized for this skill, she had to utilize an online platform. She knew that. I mean, and she's absolutely right. That is the space that we are in. How can we keep this safe in ways that also allow you to experience the benefits of it? Because most of us are using these platforms, right? Like, they're here. So let's figure out how girls can be a part of that and continue to be a part of that.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's so exciting to get to be able to talk about it. And tween girls are awesome. I just want to end it there. Thank you.
Catherine Phelps is the author of the new book, Digital Girlhoods, and a lecturer in the Gender and Women's Studies Department at UW-Madison. Her book analyzes conversations she had with preteen girls about how they use social media and the role it plays in their lives. If you're a parent or a kid, have you had conversations in your family about how you use or shouldn't use social media? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, visit a new exhibit at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, sharing the stories of Wisconsin service members after they leave the military.
A lot of these veterans not only served in military service, but they came home and continued to serve their communities.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kay Darcher-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a tribute to a tree.
A white pine in northern Wisconsin stood for more than 150 years before it met its ultimate fate. Writer Ron Weber of Weyerhaeuser reflects on the tree's resilience and how its legacy is being preserved for years to come.
About the time the Civil War was ending, a white pine seed landed in mineral soil and took root in the Oxbow area of the Flambeau River near Winter. Unlike most of its brethren, it was lucky enough to survive those fierce early years of establishment, and after a decade, stood nearly 5 feet tall. Over the next several decades, it saw others succumb to drought, blister rust, tip weevils, and even a white-tailed buck venting his aggression one October day. As the U.S. prepared to enter the war to end all wars, the pine, now a slim 50-year-old, was helping fill the void left after the logging era of the late 1800s. As time passed, it continued to send its leader skyward, and like many older beings, started to add girth to its trunk. By the end of the next World War, the 80-year-old pine had secured its place in the canopy with the other survivors of its generation. As the tree celebrated its 100th birthday, the U.S. wrestled with a variety of social issues, another war, and the reminder that the future of our environment may be too high a price to pay for progress. The pine stood steadfast as a fierce wind blew through on July 4th, 1977, changing the face of the forest in a swath of northern Wisconsin. For over 150 years, the pine had survived winds, droughts, disease, and insects. But like for all things, there is a season. The end for the big pine came when a trail improvement project was being completed. Though no one wanted to see the tree cut, it was deemed necessary for safety reasons, as the upper portion of the tree had been weakened by decay, and there was a risk of it breaking. Once cut, three 12-foot logs from the pine were brought to a local sawmill. There they were sawed and dried into 3-inch thick slabs. These would be used to construct the countertop for the service counter, a coffee table, and benches for the shower facility of the Flambeau River State Forest headquarters. As work started building the countertop, the tree, which in life was shaped by natural forces and circumstance, would now be shaped by humans into a curved 20-foot-long countertop. With care and precision, measuring twice and cutting once, workers fashioned the pieces into the correct lengths, complete with mitered ends as needed. Each piece was sanded smooth and the edges rounded. The pieces were then fit together with additional sanding required to get the mitered joints tightly fit. Once all the pieces were joined, next stood the daunting task of lifting the countertop in one piece and placing it on the base. Six staff members arranged themselves around the countertop and, like pallbearers at a funeral, carefully lifted and set it onto its final resting place. With meticulous care, a thick epoxy finish was applied and air bubbles removed. The end result is a lasting thing of beauty, a real testament to nature, human know-how, and as Leopold wrote, the unity of the hodgepodge of events called history. Most eulogies are written or spoken. The eulogy for this 150-year-old white pine is preserved there in the countertop for all visitors to see. Maybe they will even take the time to count the rings evident on the end of the countertop and be reminded that throughout history, when humans work thoughtfully with nature, they can accomplish beautiful things.
Ron Weber is a writer who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
It's Wisconsin Today.
An exhibit opening today at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum shares the stories of veterans after they left the military.
The exhibit is called Traditions, Stories of Service to Country and Community, and it runs through June 6th. It highlights stories of Wisconsinites who served in the military from the Civil War to present day.
David Zien is one of the service members featured in the exhibit. Zien's a Vietnam veteran who served in the Marine Corps from 1968 to 1970. He later became a Wisconsin state senator. Zien told the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in 2006 that after leaving the military, he became a post-traumatic stress disorder counselor with the Department of Veterans Affairs.
How did I work through it? Self-disclosure, all the psychology you read and everything else, being open about it. And I got a couple of friends who are Vietnam vets. As you know, Vietnam vets can talk to Vietnam vets a lot better,
yes,
easier, as you are. I don't usually disclose as much.
Another veteran highlighted in this new exhibit is Tara Gundrum. She served in the U.S. Marines from 1998 to 2005. She told the museum it was challenging transitioning to civilian life after her years of service.
It was hard because I felt like all the time that I had spent was kind of, you know, it wasn't wasted. And I knew that it wasn't wasted, but on paper it's wasted. It means nothing without a degree. And so I was like, in some aspect, you felt like you had to start over to achieve something that you didn't realize, like, you didn't necessarily feel that you need. Like, why do I need a degree to do what I know how to do?
Greg Krieger joins us now. He's curator of exhibits at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Greg, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
As with a lot of things that happen in your museum, it runs the gamut of, you know, Civil War era, maybe sometimes even earlier, all the way up to people still with us today, maybe just a few years or a decade out of their own military service. Can you talk about why it's important that we cover that whole scope of Wisconsin's service in the military?
A lot of these veterans, you know, not only served in military service, but they came home and continued to serve their communities, you know, civically, for instance. You know, we have governors that were military veterans, senators, representatives, you know, and then people that are, you know, still just helping out in their communities on a very local scale. They're doing, you know, bicycle rides that the funds go to benefit veterans when they come home. You know, maybe the transition from military to civic life isn't that smooth for a particular veteran. So there's programs out there, events that raise funds for, you know, helping those veterans. Just runs the gamut with the way and depth that these people served.
Walk us through the exhibit when it opens and we visit in person at the Veterans Museum. What are we going to see, both how you're telling the stories about the veterans, objects in some cases, paired with those stories?
We made an attempt to display some objects that have not been seen for a long time or perhaps never been on display. This exhibit's only going to be up for 4 months, which is a very short turnaround for us. Some of these artifacts are very delicate. We have a pair of boots that Ray Stubbe of Wauwatosa wore. He was a Navy chaplain. He served at the Siege of Khe Sanh in the Vietnam War. And he saved his pair of boots that he wore were absolutely caked with Khe Sanh mud. And those boots are still caked with Khe Sanh mud today. Wow. We actually hired a conservator to kind of semi-permanently attach the mud to the boots. But as you can imagine, that's a very delicate piece. And those boots are on display. We have a vest that Lucius Fairchild wore when he got lost his arm at the Battle of Gettysburg. And a surgeon, had to cut his sleeve off to amputate his arm. Well, we have that vest on display. As you can imagine, it's over 150 years old now, a very delicate piece. There's a flag that a gentleman brought home from the Middle East, state flag, Wisconsin state flag, and he flew it every time they stopped his Bradley fighting vehicle. And the flag was encrusted with, you know, Middle Eastern dust, let's say. And still is today. So that flag will be out on display, and you can clearly see the dirt, you know, adhering to this flag. Again, a very sensitive piece, but really neat. And just one look at it, you can tell, yeah, that went into battle for sure.
We're talking about a new exhibit showcasing the contributions of Wisconsin military veterans during and after their military service. Greg Krieger is with us, curator of exhibits at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Greg, let's dig into some of these stories a little bit. One, you've already touched on Colonel Lucius Fairchild lost his arm, as you mentioned, in the U.S. Civil War. Well, his public service didn't stop then. Can you talk about what he went on to here in Wisconsin?
When he got back to Wisconsin, he was an early advocate for veterans. Again, Wisconsin was you know, a new state at the time, and, you know, these returning veterans had a lot of needs, if you will. You know, he himself had lost an arm, and, you know, others had other challenges ahead of them. So he basically joined this group of veterans called the GAR, the Grand Army of the Republic, they named themselves, and they became very politically active. They, you know, lobbied legislatures to, you know, provide funds for these people to kind of retire, you know, and live comfortably after their service ended. Again, very early advocate, you know, that was something that was very new at the time, and was very effective. The GAR was very powerful in the late 19th and even into the early 20th century. Just a neat story.
Another veteran you highlight in the exhibit is Tara Gundrum, a Marine. You say her service is emblematic of many women who began serving in the Marines at the turn of the century. Can you talk a little bit about her? And she's another person. I think you mentioned bike rides to raise funds. She has done exactly that, biking to Washington, D.C. To raise money for memorial projects. Talk a little bit about her and her place in the exhibit.
Tara resides in Washington County, and she joined Rotary, so another civic organization that does great things. And yeah, she likes to participate in rides across Wisconsin, which is nicknamed RAW. She's an active member of the Marine Corps League. Again, just has a very big heart and is interested in giving back to her community at in her case, a local level and a greater state level.
Another name, this one is familiar to me as someone who's covered Wisconsin politics for a long time, David Zien. I knew him as State Senator Zien back in the day when I used to book him to come on public radio. What does your exhibit tell us about his military career and his activism in support of veterans?
So Dave got back to Wisconsin, and he's a big Harley guy, as a lot of people will probably know. He rode around the country just trying to raise awareness, basically, about, you know, veterans, and then, you know, coinciding like motorcyclists, right? You know, helmet laws, for instance, were a big thing in the 80s and 90s in this state. So we tried to raise awareness about that. Obviously, you know, went on to the state legislature from 1988 to 2006. He's a very nice guy. He's quite the character. Mm-hmm. You will never miss him. You know, if he rides by, again, just a great guy, great story.
Greg, what are you hoping people take away from this temporary exhibit?
I think, you know, the contribution that these Wisconsin citizens gave to not only their country but their state is really incredible. You know, they sacrificed life and limb for their country, then, you know, came home and again just continued to serve, continued to give back to their communities. And just a knowledge of that. Some of the state symbols that we think of today, like On Wisconsin, which is now our state song, that phrase was coined by Lieutenant Arthur MacArthur, who led an attack of the 24th Wisconsin with the cry On Wisconsin at the Battle of Missionary Ridge in the Civil War. You know, those are terms that we are familiar with today as kind of our state motto, you know, things of that nature. Well, you know, that was used in battle in the Civil War. So perhaps people could walk away with just a greater sense of history. That's one of the reasons why we call it traditions, because, yeah, we sing these songs, you know, we salute this flag, but we try to dig a little deeper and, okay, where did that flag come from? You know, why was that song written? Things of that nature.
Greg, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Greg Krieger is the curator of exhibits at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. The exhibit we've been talking about, Traditions, Stories of Service to Country and Community, opens today and it runs through June 6th. Do you have a story to share, if you're a veteran yourself, about how you embraced public service after you left the military? Love to hear from you, and we can share it with the Veterans Museum, too. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up Tuesday on the show, we'll meet the head of a Milwaukee mascot company that created the Brewers' famous racing sausages.
And that is Bratwurst, Polish, Italian hot dog, and chorizo, who race ahead of the seventh inning.
They'll topple over, they'll trip, and it's just kind of a fun, engaging part of the baseball experience.
And we want to know, what are your favorite team mascots? Have you ever been a mascot? What was it like wearing the suit and interacting with fans? Do you have memories you'd like to share about the Brewers racing sausages, or how about posing with Bucky Badger?
Drop us a line, send us a text at 888-642-0232, or email your mascot story to wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
And thanks for being part of Wisconsin Today.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.